An entire service industry now caters to and highlights every stage of pregnancy, from conception to delivery, breastfeeding, and beyond. Many of these services are served with a side of spirituality. Across the U.S., pregnant women can now gather and pay large sums of money for retreats at beautiful destinations where they can paint each other's bellies, dance in a circle, chant, cast spells, and more. Welcome to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm Kimberly Winston, in this week for Umbreen Khan. Anne W. Duncan spent the last couple of years studying this development and shares her insights in her new book, Sacred Pregnancy, Birth, Motherhood, and the Quest for Spiritual Community. Duncan is a professor of American Studies and Religion at Goucher College in Baltimore, and she discovered the sacred pregnancy movement while she herself was pregnant. Her new book looks at what's behind the idea of sacred pregnancy, who's in and who's left out, and what the elevation of pregnancy to sacred status may mean for the American religious landscape and for what it says about women and pregnancy in a post-Roe world. Anne Duncan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So the name of the book is Sacred Pregnancy. What is sacred pregnancy?
So the subtitle is Birth, Motherhood, and the Quest for Spiritual Community. And so the book, as sort of an overview, talks about what I call spiritual birth movements. And these are different movements who are trying to bring a sense of the sacred and ritual and community back to the experiences of pregnancy and birth. And so the book, in profiling these different groups, is trying to sort of weave together a few different threads. On the one hand, some changing paradigms about motherhood and kind of its complicated connection to feminism, but also changing religious demographics and the rise of the so-called nuns, N-O-N-E-S, or the spiritual but not religious, and the ways in which some of these services represent the emergence of some spiritual communities that address some of the unmet needs people might have and tend to blur the lines of how we define religion.
Tell us who the main players are.
So the biggest one, and the one that I spend the most time talking about and spent the most time researching, is a group called the Sacred Living Movement. And this was kind of the brainchild of a woman named Annie Dalter, who talks about her experience in pregnancy and even describes being in a prenatal yoga class and realizing that the time when people seem to have the most meaningful experiences and connection was often over tea after the yoga was finished, as they sort of talked about their common experiences and struggles. And so she started this movement as a means to create community and opportunity for ritual, all focused on bringing a sense of the sacred back to pregnancy and childbirth to start with. And so she started hosting these sacred pregnancy retreats. The movement has since expanded. They now have retreats around motherhood more generally, for relationships, retreats for men specifically, retreats focused on breastfeeding or menopause and other sort of rites of passage. But the sacred pregnancy retreats are still sort of the heart of the movement. And over the course of the weekend, they engage in a number of different rituals that involve decorating their bellies with beautiful drawings or having all kinds of flowers and beautiful garments that they dress themselves in, and have parties where they dance and take pictures and just sort of celebrating the corporeal experience of pregnancy. And these retreats sometimes involve some religious practices that we might find in other religious traditions, some different references to the spiritual, to the sacred, but don't really fall into one particular category of one specific religion or worldview. So we have that group on one hand. I also profiled a couple of women who have small businesses just outside of Washington, D.C., where they offer spiritual counseling connected with prenatal and postnatal healthcare. And so one of the kind of characteristics of their practices is offering things like womb steaming or vaginal steaming, which is a practice.
What?
Yes.
I should say for our listeners, this is right at the beginning of the book. You have this wonderful description of a woman sitting bare bottomed on a crate while special steam wafts up, shall we say, to her nether regions. I have to say that gave me great pause.
Yes. It's a practice that goes far beyond these practitioners. Most famously or infamously, Gwyneth Paltrow actually talked about this practice and advocated it through her Goop website. But it's also something that the Sacred Living Movement has as part of its postpartum rituals. We received instruction on how to actually create the box for the womb steaming and some of the different kind of herbal concoctions you might use for that treatment. And so for people who have had some kind of traumatic experience in that region of their body, there is a lot of healing that needs to happen. But what's interesting about these particular practitioners is that they combine that with spiritual counseling.
Right.
So kind of thinking about a mind-body connection. While that steaming, that treatment is happening, there's a kind of spiritual talk therapy that happens to sort of process the perhaps more psychological traumas that need healing as well.
The one that most intrigued me was the Institute for the Study of Birth, Breath, and Death.
Yes. So the Institute was started by Amy Wright Glenn, who is a woman who comes from a Mormon background, but also went to school, studied different world religions, and has a kind of pluralistic approach to thinking about religion that I think is evident in her work. But this institute provides a number of different trainings to help people prepare for careers as doulas, for example, or chaplains, or other sort of care providing professions that deal with those particular rites of passage of birth and death in particular.
And just in case some of our listeners may not know what a doula is, will you explain what a birth and death doula, what those two things are?
Sure. The term doula in its origin means female slave, but has been kind of reclaimed, I guess, beginning in the 1960s and 70s. By a group of women who sort of developed this practice of companioning people through birth. And so it has come to mean sort of a woman's companion. And so these are people who are often hired to attend a birth with the couple, not as a medical provider, but as an advocate and as a support. You know, when the birthing person is sort of in the midst of labor, sometimes it can be hard to advocate for yourself or to remember what your sort of priorities were before you were in the thick of it. But doulas have expanded to now be available to companion people, be with people through many different kinds of experiences. So there are abortion doulas now, there are postpartum doulas, people who are there to be with someone going through that process and to help support them in ways that are necessary. Death doulas have also become more prominent, and these are people who companion people in their last hours, their last days. And one of the ways that Amy Wright Glenn talks about it is in terms of holding space. So she talks a lot about being a person who creates and holds space for people as they are going through some sort of experience. She does a lot around infant loss and pregnancy loss.
Yes.
And I went through a training with her where she focuses on the lack of ritual that many of our religions have, many of our different cultural groups have, for really dealing with miscarriage, stillbirth, and other types of pregnancy and infant loss. And she really recognizes the value of having rituals to process she sort of integrates a lot of spirituality, a lot of spiritual kind of language into those trainings for people who are going to go out and hopefully provide these services for others.
You've told me a little bit about what I can expect if I go to something. My belly would be painted. You describe them as rituals. And I want to ask you about that word, because you chose that word ritual as opposed to calling it activities. What makes it ritual as opposed to activities? Why is it sacred pregnancy instead of special pregnancy or some other word?
In the case of these movements, I use the term ritual because these different activities are chosen very intentionally to be performed, to do, not just to have something to do or to create community, but because they help facilitate the processing of something monumental that has happened. So, for example, in the sacred postpartum training that I went through, I learned about all of these different things that I, you know, could offer to someone in that postpartum period. And they include things like creating an herbal bath for the mother to lie in. The act of preparing it for her, spending the time and putting the intention into creating a special and restful and healing experience, is half of the point of it. There are rose petals, you know, flower petals put into the water. There are candles that are lit. There are special herbal infusions that are added to the water to help with the healing. The mother is invited into that space as kind of an honored person to, you know, enter this bath and to take that time to heal, to relax, to be cared for. There are other rituals, like the postpartum practitioner might create a journal and beautifully decorate the front of it, and then sit with that postpartum person and ask them to tell their birth story and record it in that journal. But that process of writing down that story is also about really witnessing and hearing and deeply listening to the experience that that person had, which might have been a beautiful experience, might have been traumatic, might have turned out the way that they wanted, maybe not. But that process of setting aside the time to really hear and validate that experience as something more than just something that produced a baby, but as something that was a monumental experience with all kinds of repercussion, physically, emotionally, psychologically, for the birthing person, that makes it more than just a writing down of a story. It makes it a ritual where both people involved have very particular roles. There is a serious intention to it that is connected to the weight of the experience, the rite of passage that that person is going through.
There's also, in the creation of these rituals around pregnancy, there's a carving out of, for lack of a better word, what I would call sacred space, sacred time. It's separate from the mundane. There's obviously ritual, but one thing there is not, at least in the groups that you looked at, is doctrine. Tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah, so part of what I play around with in this book is the question of definition. You know, there are all of these different studies that have been coming out over the last 10, 15 years talking about how in the United States, there are more and more people who are moving away from religion, who are not seeing organized religion as a central part of their life. At the same time, some of these different studies show that people still believe in something like a God in pretty high numbers, or some kind of divine order to the world, something more than just what we see. And they also really desire community. And so these groups in some ways are responding to that. They do not set out a particular doctrine. They often incorporate some different religious and spiritual rituals or ideas from a variety of different traditions, but do not sort of set out a comprehensive worldview that people mm-hmm. need to ascribe to. People are able to participate in this, receive some of these services sort of regardless of what their religious affiliation might be. And so, you know, there is an element of, if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So yes. there's some, you know, evidence to suggest that this is some religious activity happening. But there's also a real pragmatic benefit in not labeling it as a religion, and that it means that a greater variety of people can take part. And it creates a really interesting kind of interreligious climate at some of these retreats, for example.
You do an interview with Ann Dalter, and she says there's a point in sacred pregnancy retreats where she asks the participants to connect to something higher. And she says in the book, I don't care if that's God. I don't care if it's Jesus. I don't care if it's Allah. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in you finding what speaks to you.
Yes. And so she's done retreats specifically with certain religious groups. And so there's a kind of openness and adaptability. I term it radical inclusion, that is a characteristic of some of these movements. But that's not without some pitfalls and some areas of tension.
Participants have included Muslims, Jews, even conservative Christians, and then Hasidic Jews. So there's something that this movement is tapping into, even for people who are, you know, affiliated.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's something really to pay attention to, because this is not something that fits into our definitions of religion. And there's a sort of danger that people who study American religion might miss something like this just because it does not fit into one of those boxes. But yet, there are religious elements to it, and there are a lot of religious people who are engaging with it.
My guest is Ann W. Duncan, professor of American Studies and Religion at Goucher College. When we return, we'll look at the business side of sacred pregnancy. You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. Stay with us.
Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska, and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show.
Welcome back to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm Kimberly Winston. We've been learning about the sacred pregnancy movement with author Ann W. Duncan. While sacred pregnancy services are widely available, the majority of women who seek them are largely white and upper middle class. And many of these services borrow rituals and ideas freely from other cultures that are not white. I asked Duncan what kind of tension that creates.
you say in the book that the majority of people who participate are white, middle class, and upper middle class. I think you say it ranges in price from like $70 to $3,500 for certain things. So who's being left out?
So on the one hand, I think I would like to differentiate between the groups that I profiled, because that characterization that you described absolutely describes the sacred living movement. The womb sauna business that I profiled in the outskirts of Washington, D.C., that's led by two Black women. They provide services primarily to Black women in that area. And part of their explicit purpose is to address inadequacies of healthcare, and in particular, the inequities in how Black women in particular have been treated, especially around maternal and reproductive healthcare. And so there is absolutely some difference in these different groups. When we're talking about the big elaborate retreats, those absolutely cost a whole lot of money. And so there's an issue there of sort of thinking about money in connection to religious and spiritual practice in general, but also that question of exclusion. So thinking about the kind of commercialization in some ways of religious or spiritual ritual, I think, yes, that definitely has the chance of necessarily excluding people who don't have those means. And I think that's something that some of these movements, the sacred living movement in particular, is trying to address through special scholarships, intentional reaching out to a broader demographic, but it remains a problem. At the same time, I think there is a sort of paradigm or assumption in the United States that there needs to be a real separation of money and religious or spiritual practice, that we don't like to talk about money in relationship to a church, a synagogue, a mosque. But at the same time, money is absolutely involved, right? They have to pay their clergy. They have to keep the lights on. So religion is not free.
Right.
It is structured in a particular way. But to say that charging a price for participation is necessarily wholly different from what happens in a church on a Sunday, I think is not quite right. But this is one of the ways in which these groups are really kind of unsettling our paradigms of what religion looks like, to think that it could be connected to a business, that it could be something that you pay for participation in a very direct transactional way.
It's some of the same criticism that's been leveled at, say, spiritual / business endeavors like SoulCycle. Another criticism leveled at these folks is cultural appropriation, that the participants are engaging in ritual practices, prayers, maybe chanting, things that come from cultures other than their own. Why should we be worried about that or not?
So yes, that is absolutely a characterization, particularly of the sacred living movement, and perhaps a kind of byproduct of not having sort of a doctrine and specific rituals of their own, that they're instead sort of pulling from all of these different sources. And there is kind of a universalistic perspective behind that, that we're all sort of, you know, climbing up that same mountain, trying to get to the same goal. And so whatever tools are available and are beneficial should be used. The problem comes in when we think about power dynamics, and most definitions of cultural appropriation, as opposed to, say, cultural appreciation, involve those power dynamics where the practices, the communities, the cultures, the religions in this case that are being borrowed from are minority traditions, minority cultures in that place where they are being borrowed, and that those who are doing the borrowing have a level of cultural power and influence that is out of proportion with those that they are borrowing from. And so that power dynamic is important, especially when those practices are borrowed in a way that does not recognize their origins, educate about the origin and sort of original intent behind something, to kind of give it respect and give some context for its practice. Now, some of these groups, Sacred Living Movement in particular, do provide some of that context, particularly in their trainings, where they talk about where a practice comes from and why it's meaningful. Often it's in the language of, you know, this is a practice that has been done for centuries, and it, you know, sort of reclaiming an old wisdom and bringing it to the present moment. But in the retreats themselves, and sometimes in the midst of a ritual, that kind of context is not necessarily provided. And I think that's where it definitely seems to cross some lines there, and is something to certainly pay attention to. And I think you're right in pointing to some of these other movements. I mean, we can think about the use of yoga in the United States and all of the ways in which that is practiced without any attention to its origins or its sort of spiritual focus in its original form. So this is not something unique to these groups. There is something very American about this kind of borrowing and blending.
It is very American. And there was something else that jumped out at me about being very American. You were interviewing a leader in the Sacred Living Movement, and she said that sacred pregnancy addresses a very American problem, cultural loss of assimilation. And I took that to mean that as different peoples come to the United States from other cultures, that as they assimilate, they lose some of their cultural practices, and that people are creating new rituals.
To say that this is one of the sort of downsides to American assimilation is that because we are such a, you know, a melting pot of all these different religious traditions, different backgrounds, that that can lead to a whole lot of loss of language, of food practices, of other kinds of cultural practices. And that that's even more the case when we think about how we recognize different rites of passage, that when people are not living in communities surrounded by others who are coming from that same tradition, where those kinds of traditions, those rituals can be easily practiced and continued, they're often just lost. And so the Sacred Living Movement in particular is trying to address that by bringing back ritual, bringing back a sense of the sacred, to say, pregnancy and birth, these are not just physical things that happen to a body. They are not just medical events. That these are rites of passage that throughout time have been marked with ritual and have been treated with care, where the focus isn't just on the outcome of that baby, but a real focus on the birthing person too, and what they are going through, and how as a culture we've really lost that kind of intentional focus, and that there is a real opportunity there that when people go through this, they can touch the sacred, they can have spiritual experiences, are brought to their highest highs, lowest lows, which makes these life events really wonderful opportunities for spiritual reflection, for ritual, for community building, and for the cultivation of the kinds of practices, the kinds of sort of slowing down, creating and holding space that these movements really advocate for. And that's something that they argue used to be common and is no longer, particularly in the United States. Mm.
You say in the conclusion section of the book, while I was writing this book, the Supreme Court of the United States overturned Roe v. Wade as the law of the land. And I think that really shifted the way I perceived the title and cover of this book. I know it's not news to you that the anti-abortion movement in the United States has often used words pulled from religion and spirituality to describe pregnancy, life, giving birth. You know, there's the quote, sanctity of life. For a long time, the catchphrase was the ensoulment of the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Life is a gift from God. Did the overturning of Roe v. Wade in any way change your focus on spiritual pregnancy movements? Did it change the way any of these groups go about what they do?
Absolutely. So I want to start by just recognizing that, yes, these are some choppy waters.
Yeah.
I also think that what I talk about in this book and what these movements are trying to do is a really interesting kind of third way, in that one of the challenges I think that the feminist movement has had in dealing with abortion rights and conversations about not only bodily autonomy, but also vocational and personal possibility. And I think a lot of what the feminist movement, particularly second wave, faced as a challenge was how to advocate for women's autonomy without negatively characterizing motherhood more generally. It was sort of a, you know, either or kind of decision. And I think third wave feminism has certainly muddied those waters in a lot of ways. But this is a means of elevating those experiences in a way that I think has the potential to elevate all of the different kinds of experiences and choices that people who can become pregnant and give birth have. Because one of the things that it does is it sort of enters into the conversation of how we think about motherhood, because we have a kind of complicated situation where we sort of deify mothers on the one hand and sort of hold them up on a pedestal in many ways, but also can kind of dehumanize and take away autonomy from people who have the ability to become a mother. And this is sort of elevating that person to focus on their choices, their experiences, in ways that take them very seriously.
As I'm reading the book's description of what goes on at some of mm-hmm. sacred pregnancy retreats, I had a flash of a scene out of Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale. When one of the handmaids finally gets pregnant, you know, this
right.
adoration of her belly. And, mm-hmm. this, mm-hmm. you know, everybody lays their hands on her belly and she is elevated to this certain status. And that made my alarm bells go off.
It is uncomfortable and it can be tricky to elevate motherhood, to elevate pregnancy and birth. But I don't think that that means that it's necessarily problematic to do so. I think one of the challenges with some of these groups is that with the more explicit focus on pregnancy and childbirth, that necessarily excludes people who are not going through that or can't, you know, because of their own fertility struggles or their life circumstance. And so it's necessarily exclusive in a way that a more traditional religion might not be. But I also think that some of these movements, sacred living movement as one example, is just continually adding new trainings, new retreats to sort of speak to people at different life moments and dealing with different issues. So I think there is a responsiveness to that, but I think, you know, even as these groups can be so radically inclusive in terms of religious affiliation and what you believe and all of that, they can be very exclusive in terms of, you know, are you in the midst of that particular rite of passage, or are you seeing pregnancy as something to be really celebrated in these ways?
I've been speaking with Anne W. Duncan, author of Sacred Pregnancy, Motherhood, Birth, and the Quest for Spiritual Community. When we come back, we'll look at some of the words and phrases used to describe women, mothers, and babies in the history of women's reproductive rights. You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices.